I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Crimeans voted yesterday overwhelmingly to secede from Ukraine and join the Russian Federation. The Ukrainian government called the referendum a circus orchestrated by Moscow at gunpoint. 13 members of the UN Security Council called the referendum illegal, including the United States. The U.S., along with European governments, have approved economic sanctions against Russia and travel restrictions against some officials. Critics of the referendum largely boycotted the vote on Sunday. So today in Radio Times, we talk about the fate of Crimea and Ukraine, U.S. relations with Russia, and the impact of this crisis on geopolitical alliances. And we have two guests. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is William Burke White, Deputy Dean, Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. From 2009 to 2011, he served in the Obama administration on Secretary of State Clinton's policy planning staff, advising on a number of issues, including Russia. And Bill, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
A pleasure to be here.
And joining us by telephone is Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. And from 1998 to 2000, he was Ambassador to Ukraine. And Ambassador Pfeiffer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to join you today.
I'd like to begin with you. Has Ukraine lost Crimea?
My guess is it's a long way gone, and a lot will depend on what Vladimir Putin does. He's giving a speech to the Russian parliament tomorrow, and he really has two options. Option number one is that Russia moves very quickly to annex Crimea. The Crimeans have asked for that. And if that happens, unfortunately, Crimea is not ever going to get back to Ukraine. The other option would be for the Russians to basically leave things as they are, leave Crimea in sort of a limbo status. And that would leave at least a glimmer of hope that you could get to a negotiating process that might de-escalate the crisis back. But it's going to be a very hard pull for the Ukrainians to recover sovereignty over Crimea.
And is this a Putin's decision alone to make?
Pretty much Mr. Putin's call. I mean, this is one where I don't think he's going to have anyone other than himself when he thinks about which way to go on this. Now, as I said, I think it's going to be very hard for Ukraine to recover Crimea. It's still going to be very important, however, that the West not recognize this. And I think Russia is probably going to be the only country in the world that recognizes the results of yesterday's referendum in Crimea as something legitimate.
Bill, let me turn to you. And in my introduction, talking about the fact that at least as of today, the institution of some sanctions, some travel restrictions, and the U.S., the U.N., other EU, all calling this illegal. What options do the critics of this move, what options do they have?
The sad fact is very few options. You know, the most obvious option would be the use of military force. And given Russia's power in the international system, that's just off the table. That's not going to happen. And Putin knows it. What we've tried instead is a series of economic sanctions, mostly targeted at particular Russian and Crimean pro-Russian leaders. Those, I'm afraid, are going to have relatively little impact. They may create some backlash in the business community, but Putin has essentially bought that community off over the years in a way that he doesn't have to respond. Beyond that, you have diplomacy and political isolation of Russia, and we've tried that with Europe to join us in doing so, but Russia is largely immune from that. They are a permanent member of the Security Council. They have a seat at the G8, at the BRIC summit, at all of these world tables. I think all you can really try to do is create a broad enough political coalition against Russia that Putin is forced to reconsider. And that means moving well beyond just Europe and the United States complaining loudly, as we've been doing.
Well, Stephen Pfeiffer, let me go back to you. You were the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Ukraine obviously calling this illegal, calling it a circus. What options does Ukraine have? Any different from what Bill was just talking about?
Well, Ukraine is in a difficult situation. I mean, it, like the West, does not have a viable military option. And in fact, Ukraine does have forces in Crimea, but very wisely, they have urged great restraint. They've stayed on their bases. They have not challenged the Russians. Now, I do think if there's a wider Russian military intervention into Ukraine proper, that you may see some Ukrainian military units resist, and then we're into a whole new level of crisis with an actual shooting war. I would go back, though, and say I think, as Bill said, Western options are limited because the West is not prepared to go to war over Crimea. And certainly the sanctions that were announced today by the White House and the European Union targeting individual Russians will have some impact. It's not going to have a big impact. But there still are wider sanctions out there that the West could use, including financial sanctions aimed, for example, at shutting down credit to Russia. Mm. And it's kind of interesting. Neither Washington nor Europe has yet decided to invoke those sanctions, but they're already going into effect because the markets are anticipating this. So you've seen the Russian stock market, you know, losing probably 20% of its value over the last several weeks. You've seen Goldman Sachs reportedly on Friday, it revised its estimate of Russian gross domestic product growth in 2014 down from 3% to 1%. And you've seen anecdotal reports out of Moscow that Russian companies are beginning to have harder times now borrowing from commercial banks, which anticipate that there may be sanctions in the future.
Interesting. Let me go back to you, Bill, something that you have written about, and Vladimir Putin talks about Kosovo, saying, look what Kosovo did, using that as an example of what the voters in Crimea did, which was essentially to decide they wanted to leave Ukraine and join the Russian Federation. Yeah, why doesn't that work?
So there's a principle that of international law that actually goes back as far as Woodrow Wilson's 14 points after World War I, and that's self-determination. The idea that an oppressed people that has been subject to either colonial domination or long-term violence and oppression has a right to choose its own governance and future. And that's the principle that was behind Kosovo. It was behind East Timor that invoked independence back in 2002 and most recently in South Sudan. But there's a couple of key differences here. First of all, while the Russian people in Crimea are an ethnic minority, speak Russian and have a different culture, they have not been subject to a systematic oppression. Take the people of, say, Quebec, right? They may be a distinct people in Canada, but they haven't been subject to a long-standing oppression. Secondly, there hasn't been a real period of deliberation that allows those people to choose a separate course for their future. And in order to invoke self-determination, you have to have that oppression and then a real period for deliberation. And what's really being done here is that principle of self-determination is being invoked in a deeply skewed way to claim a right of independence for Kosovo, for Crimea, that really doesn't exist in international law.
I'd be curious about your response, Stephen Pfeiffer.
No, I think that's a very good point. If you go back and look at the case of Kosovo, in 1988 and 99, you had ethnic cleansing on a massive scale. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of Kosovo Albanians fled Kosovo. And then after the conflict, after Kosovo broke away, there was almost a decade of negotiations between Kosovo and Serbia trying to work out a mutual agreement by which Kosovo would be recognized as an independent state. And only when those failed after nearly 10 years did Kosovo declare independence in 2008. And since then, it's been recognized by nearly 100 countries around the world. In the case of Crimea, there was no ethnic cleansing. Crimea is the one place in Ukraine where ethnic Russians are in the majority, about 59% of the population. I traveled there a number of times when I was posted in Ukraine at the end of the 1990s, and I've been back four or five times over the last 5 years, and you never got a sense of any real tension between ethnic Russians and ethnic Ukrainians. There was just, the issues are just between Crimea and Kosovo, they just can't be compared. And even a month ago in Crimea, there was no real talk of secession. It really only happened after the change of government in Kyiv, and it has very much the appearance that the Russians stirred it up.
What do you think, and this is to you, Stephen Pfeiffer, as former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, what does Putin want?
I think Putin wants a couple of things here, and it may not be that Crimea is his primary goal. I think what Putin wants, and going back to last summer when the Russians begin to apply pressure on Ukraine in terms of blocking certain Ukrainian exports to Russia, the concern was that Ukraine was on track to sign an association agreement that would bring it closer to the European Union. And after former President Yanukovych fled the capital on February 21, and then he left the country several days later, the acting cabinet in Ukraine has made very clear that it wants to do that association agreement with the European Union. So I think the first goal here for Vladimir Putin is he does not want to see Ukraine draw closer to the European Union, because that takes Ukraine out of Russia's geopolitical orbit, and that's a big deal for him. Crimea is in part a tactic to increase the pressure on Ukraine proper, And perhaps if he ends up losing Ukraine to Europe, you know, he may consider Crimea as the consolation prize. But there very much is that push, both in geopolitical terms, but I think there's also here a domestic political factor, which for Putin, for his conservative political base, trying to pull Ukraine, trying to pull Crimea back towards Russia is seen as a good thing. The flip side is he also doesn't want to be seen as the person who lost Ukraine or Crimea.
Mm, what do you think, Ben?
Yeah, let me jump in on the domestic politics part of that, because I think that's a big piece of the story. If you go back to Putin's political trajectory over the last 15 years, soon before the Olympics started in February, he was probably at his weakest in terms of his domestic political position in Russia. He was at the end of essentially his third term of leading Russia in various different positions, but he was seen as relatively weak. And what do you do when you're seen as weak? You create a conflict and an enemy. And he's done that. He has now jumped back in the polls, partly because of the relatively successful Olympics and now because of Ukraine. And I think he is today seen as a much stronger figure. He has bolstered his cult of personality of this sort of Russian strongman who sometimes is seen flying with eagles or diving for pirate treasure, and is now seen as the person who's beginning to reunite a Soviet Union. And I'm not saying his ultimate goal is to truly recreate the Soviet Union, but that plays into a domestic political narrative that significantly bolsters his political status at home.
Well, talking about the Sochi Olympics, wouldn't that have been enough to to make him a more popular figure in his own country?
I think it started that process. I'm not sure Putin can ever be popular and strong enough for his own image, and this takes it much further. But, a global Olympics is a good staging moment. A reacquisition of a key piece of territory is perhaps even a bigger one for him, and I think his political future is now tied up in the resolution of Ukraine and in the sort of reconstruction of a stronger Russia, which is something that taps deep into a kind of narrative within the Russian people of a strong country and a strong government.
Do you think, Stephen Pfeiffer, that we are sort of reliving the Cold War?
Well, I think certainly we are headed to a situation where U.S. and Russia relations may be as bumpy as they've been since any time since the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. But having said that, if you go back and you consider the Cold War, that was an area of ideological, political, military competition across the board. And hopefully there will be enough wisdom in Washington and Moscow that while we're going to head for a more difficult period, we can avoid a return to that kind of conflict.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about the crisis in Ukraine and Crimea over the weekend. The people of Crimea, about 90-some percent of them, voted to secede from Ukraine and to join the Russian Federation. We're talking about what that means for the region, what that means for the United States and its allies, and how this crisis possibly threatens geopolitical alliances. The voice you just heard is Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer. He was U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine from 1998 to 2000. He's currently Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. Also with us is William Burke White, Deputy Dean, Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. And he was an advisor in the Obama administration on Secretary of State Clinton's policy planning staff. 1-888-477-9499. What do you think the options are? Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bristol Riverside Theater supports WHYY and presents Laughter on the 23rd Floor, March 18th through April 13th. From Neil Simon's real-life experience on The Sid Caesar Show, this comedy follows the writing, fighting, and wacky antics in the writer's room of a weekly variety show. With characters based on Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, and Sid Caesar, Simon showcases the jokes and banter of the original Kings of Comedy. Tickets at brtstage.org or 215-785-0100.
Steve, let me ask you something. When you're hosting NPR's Morning Edition, how do you keep all those news stories straight in your head?
By listening. I don't pretend to know all the answers. My job is to know who to ask and how to ask them. At NPR's Morning Program, our job is to push for real stories, honest answers.
And you can listen with us on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, activists push for states to cut off water to NSA facilities.
We're not going to participate. We're not going to allow the use of our resources to the NSA to continue its violation of our rights.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and William Burke White from the University of Pennsylvania Law School. We have calls coming in, and you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Ambassador, I'd like to go back to you, and the critics of the Obama administration say that the Obama administration has been weak on this issue, and if they'd only been more overt, I guess, about Syria or maybe even Benghazi, that we wouldn't be in the situation that we are in today with Russia. Do you agree with that assessment at all?
Well, I'm not going to fully defend the Obama administration's handling of Syria, but I think it's a mistake to make that assertion. Go back and look what happened in 2008 when Russia and Georgia found themselves in a conflict. And if you look at the measures that the Bush administration was able to take, I mean, it basically ruled out a military response, and it did two things. It suspended congressional consideration of a civil nuclear cooperation agreement with Russia, and it stopped supporting Russia's accession to the World Trade Organization. I think the Obama administration has actually been able to take stronger political and diplomatic measures, in part because this time Europe is acting in a different way. In 2008, while the Russians certainly, I think, set up a situation where war was likely, what caused the war was a miscalculation by the Georgian government. They, in effect, began it. In this case, I think what Europe has seen is that the Russians, unprovoked, 2 weeks ago, occupied Crimea with their military, and that's provoked a much more robust reaction on the part of the Europeans. And I think there's very much a view here in Washington that the United States and Europe, if they work together, are going to have a much stronger message to Moscow. So I think the administration is trying to find ways to push back at the Russians, but they're also trying at the same time to leave an escape route for Moscow, to try to encourage Russia to go down the route of some kind of negotiation, which is the only real way that you're going to de-escalate this crisis.
You worked with former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on a number of issues, including Russia. Mm-hmm. And the word was the reset relationship with Russia. How do you understand the U.S.-Russian relationship?
So when the Obama administration came into power, the U.S.-Russian relations were in a terrible state. Essentially, Bush and Putin had really stopped having any meaningful relation, and even our military-to-military cooperation had pretty much dried up. And so the reset was an effort to try to restart that relationship, to bring it back to life, to find new terms to cooperate. It was partly driven by the fact that the U.S. knew we needed Russia on things like Iran sanctions and in the Security Council. What we've seen over the last 6 years, though, is that the reset really didn't work. It worked for a little while in the beginning, but where there were real differences of opinion, it was impossible to bring the two countries together. And so at the moment, as we began the Crimea crisis, relations were already very shaky. There was not much sense that Russia was a real partner on any of these issues. So there wasn't much left to lose on either side, frankly. And I think that's why it's been so hard to get the Russians to listen, and why there's really not a deep sense of trust that we can build on to move forward at the moment.
Are we allies? Are we enemies? Are we frenemies? I mean, how would you...
Frenemies is a good word. You know, Bill Clinton added Russia to the G8, which used to be this group of like-minded nations. Russia comes in. It's no longer all like-minded. And that, you know, the difference in opinion between Russia and the G8 has become very clear. But Russia is also part of the G20. It's a necessary partner at the Security Council. So you have to be able to work with Russia at times, which gets you the friend part.
Yeah.
At the same time, we have basically irreconcilable differences on a whole series of issues with very little progress on them.
How do you see it, Stephen Pfeiffer?
No, I think it's that same mix. And this is one of the challenges for American foreign policy is, on the one hand, how do you work to punish Russia? And in this case, Russia deserves to be penalized for really an action that fundamentally breaks the rules that have applied within Europe since the end of the Cold War back in 1990. So you've got to punish them, and there must be consequences for this action, in part because you don't want the Russians to think that they could do it again somewhere else. But at the same time, you want to find a way that on issues where American and Russian interests coincide, such as preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, you want to be able to work together on those kinds of questions. And that's difficult. It requires a very careful balancing act when you're working on questions where you're both have common interests, but other issues where there are deep differences like there are on the question of Ukraine and Crimea.
But part of that scenario, could you imagine a Crimea that had even more autonomy than it has now but stays part of Ukraine? Is that a possible option?
That might be an option. I mean, but it was kind of interesting. I mean, and one of the reasons why I think people have a hard time taking this referendum as legitimate was there were only two options. Option number one was to join Russia. Option number two was to go back to a 1992 Crimean constitution, which had so much autonomy that, in fact, it was rejected by Kyiv. If you were a Crimean who wanted to have Crimea stay within Ukraine in the context of the current constitutional arrangements, you had no chance to vote. But I think if you could get back to a dialogue, my guess is that the government in Ukraine, which is very interested in maintaining its sovereignty over Crimea, might be willing to entertain a conversation as to other forms of autonomy that could be extended to Crimea.
But
and hopefully, if the Russians do not move to annex, that at least creates the possibility that you could have that conversation. If the Russians move to annex Crimea, though, that's lost.
As we know, John Kerry, Secretary of State John Kerry, has been in conversation with his counterpart in Russia, but it hasn't borne the kind of fruit that he's looking for. Do you agree, Ambassador?
Yeah, no, I think the Secretary has tried very hard with Foreign Minister Lavrov. I think President Obama has tried with President Putin. But so far, there's no evidence to suggest that they've had much impact. Again, we'll see tomorrow when President Putin addresses the Russian parliament what he plans to do. My guess is that in the 6 hours of conversation between Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov on Friday, a big part of the Secretary's effort was trying to persuade the Russians, don't do something that locks you in. Annexing Crimea would lock Russia in. So I think part of it is, go to that option of leaving Crimea in limbo, which at least creates the possibility that there might be some kind of a dialogue and some kind of path out of this mess.
Bill, you have an interesting idea about involving not necessarily European countries, but also involving countries like China. Help us understand your thinking.
So, one thing that's worth noting first is that on yesterday as well, the foreign ministry in Russia did release a proposal to create a contact group of nations to come together and discuss this. And if you take that path, you might move to a position where Crimea was part of a broader negotiation on Ukraine's future. And my view is that you have to get a broader coalition involved in that conversation than just the U.S. and Europe. China is, of course, a rising power today, has a lot of voice in the international system, and one Russia might listen to. China also has real concerns about this version of self-determination being invoked in places like Tibet or with the Uyghurs in parts of Western China. Similarly, India has real concerns about Pakistan or China using military force along its border. And I think you could bring countries like India and China into that conversation. And suddenly, if you had India, China, Brazil, Europe, and the United States, all part of a negotiating group where Russia was truly isolated, isolated from the West, isolated from the BRIC, the rising powers, you might be in a position to put a lot more pressure on Putin than we can do with Brussels alone.
And that's William Burke White from the University of Pennsylvania Law School, also former advisor to former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and also with us, joining us by telephone, Stephen Pfeiffer, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, who's with the Brookings Institution. We have a lot of phone calls, so let me get some callers to join our conversation. We have Barbara from Bluebell joining us on Radio Times. Barbara, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty. As always, you're doing a great job with
Thank
the
you.
Show.
Thank you.
My comment is that we talk a lot about Putin and his interests in Ukraine. Nobody talks about what are the real interests of America and European Union, and I'm from that region. What are the interests in Ukraine? The other short question is, what is the history of executive orders and who's behind?
Okay, well, let me take the one about what the U.S. or perhaps the EU, what their interest is in Ukraine, and I'll put that to the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me give you three reasons why I think that the United States needs to take a deep interest in what's going on in Ukraine. First of all, this is a crisis that could very easily spin out of control. If you have one nervous Russian soldier or one nervous Ukrainian soldier fires a shot, there could be a shooting war. So we ought to be engaged now, because if there's a deeper crisis a couple of weeks or a couple months down the road, we're going to get pulled in then in any case. The second reason is this is such a fundamental breaking of the rules in Europe that it's important that the United States make sure that there are political, diplomatic, and economic consequences for Moscow. Russia needs to understand that these sorts of things are not acceptable. Now, those consequences may not be enough to force Vladimir Putin to change his mind, but he needs to know that there will be a Western reaction, in part so that we can discourage him from thinking about doing this in the future. And then the third reason that goes back to a very much Ukraine, which is in 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine had on its territory the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world, including 1,900 intercontinental ballistic missile warheads and air-launched cruise missiles that were designed to attack the United States. The United States spent several years working with Ukraine to persuade Ukraine to agree to give that arsenal up, to transfer the warheads, to Russia for elimination. In 1994, as a big part of that agreement, the Ukrainians agreed, but one of their concerns was they wanted to have security assurances. And in December of 1994, the United States, Russia, and Britain signed with Ukraine the Budapest Memorandum on Security Assurances, in which the three countries, America, Russia, and Britain, pledged to respect Ukraine's territorial integrity, its independence, its sovereignty, pledged not to use force against it. Russia now is in violation of those commitments, and I believe it's incumbent on America and Britain to respond. Now, there are a couple of last points. The memorandum is on security assurances, not guarantees, and we were very clear at the time, and Kyiv understood that we were not talking about a military commitment, but certainly assurances implies political, diplomatic, and economic support. And so this is, in part, it's about an obligation that we have to Ukraine that we undertook in 1994 to get rid of those nuclear weapons, which was a very important American foreign policy goal. But there's also a second issue, which is that if you look at future nuclear proliferation challenges, North Korea or Iran, and you think about what might, for example, get us to a permanent settlement with Iran on its nuclear program, or North Korea, which is going to be a harder problem, but security assurances might play a role in both of those cases. And if the United States is not seen as having lived up to the security assurances it made Ukraine in 1994, we remove what could be potentially an important tool from our non-proliferation toolkit.
What do you think, Bill?
I agree with all that. I think that, you know, for me, the most important aspect is probably the single most important bedrock principle of the international order since 1945, and that is that no state shall use force to acquire territory of another state. And that is what Russia is doing here. And the preservation and protection of that principle is utterly essential to the preservation of the international system as a whole. Now, the United States has at times used force in questionable ways. We have not used force in an effort to acquire another state's territory. And Vladimir Putin himself called out President Obama for thinking about using force in Syria for a very different reason, not to acquire territory, in the New York Times in an op-ed in September of this year. And Putin writes in that op-ed that this would be a violation of the UN Charter and the principle of non-aggression. And that principle is what's at stake here. And I think we have to make it very clear that in the modern era, no state shall use force to acquire territory of another state. It's what led us in Iraq back in the first Iraq War to create a broad coalition. It's a principle that all states can buy into, and Russia is challenging that principle and thereby challenging the bedrock of the international order.
And what's so interesting is that Putin uses Kosovo as an example, but Russia does not
recognize Kosovo's independence.
Just to sort of add to the wrinkle. But something you were telling me, Bill, and I wanted to just give you a chance to say it on the air, then we'll get back to our callers, is that Russia does want access to the Black Sea. So that's also part of this.
It is an important
issue.
Part of it, right? Russia has its major Western military naval presence on the Black Sea, and having access to the Black Sea is very important. This assures them of that naval access, which was part of the agreements that the ambassador just spoke about, that Russia would be able to rent that space. But Russia does have a military national security interest in it.
Let me get Wolfgang.
Can I add just very quickly on
that? Oh, please,
point,
yes, go ahead.
Because I think there's an important consideration is that Russia has had military installations in Crimea, including where it homeports a large portion of its Black Sea fleet, going back to a bilateral treaty from 1997. And actually, the Russian fleet was there since the breakup of the Soviet Union. And under a deal done in 2010, that presence was basically agreed until 2042. Now, it's true at some point the new government in Kyiv might have asked to revisit those questions, but in the last 4 weeks, there has been no suggestion by the new Ukrainian government that it wanted to undo those agreements. And I would argue that Russia's interest in having access to port facilities to support its Black Sea Fleet was not in danger. So any claim that they had to conduct this military operation to secure those installations strikes me as without good foundation.
Let me get Wolfgang from Princeton to join us. Wolfgang, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning,
Marty. Excellent show.
Thank you.
Hi, Bill and everybody. I'm just back from Berlin, and I would like to add another ominous perspective here. I agree wholeheartedly with everything which was said so far. The one element which has developed now is that Vladimir Putin managed to release this notion of angst of the Russians.
Angst.
Fear.
Fear.
And that's particularly important for the smaller states who are successor states of the former Soviet Empire, the Baltic states, the states in the Caucasus we mentioned, but even Kazakhstan and others, which big states in Central Asia, namely those states where there are Russian minorities. And I, with very big surprise, heard for the first time the notion of Russian unification.
Mm.
Now, the crisis we have now, I consider it a game changer, a fundamental one. And Bill Burkright was absolutely correct. It changes and it touches upon the order of the post-1945 period in Europe, Helsinki, one could even say, oh my, post-1914.
Well, you know, Wolfgang, only because we're almost up on a break here, and I just want to give actually our guest, Bill, a chance to respond to your comments, the notion of sort of fomenting angst.
Wolfgang, always a pleasure to reconnect on, and better on radio than anywhere else, I suppose. I agree with you completely. There is this sudden fear among other populations outside of Russia. There's a big Russian diaspora in those communities. And there's a sense, I think, of, oh my goodness, what if the Soviet Union were to be reconstructed? Could this be the first step? And that's another reason why it's very important that we put down a marker that says, no, this cannot become the new norm, and you can't use your diaspora population as an excuse to expand your territory and recreate the Soviet Union.
Any comment in 30 seconds, Stephen Pfeiffer?
Yeah, no, just to add, I mean, take Kazakhstan, the largest country in Central Asia. 40% of their population is ethnic Russian. They tend to be concentrated in the northern part of the country along the Russian border. And my guess that in Astana, the capital of Kazakhstan, in the last couple of weeks, they've become a little bit more nervous. Mm. You've also seen that in the Baltic states, particularly Estonia and Latvia, which have ethnic Russian populations of about 25%. And one of the things that the Obama administration has done is basically sent some American aircraft there sort of to reassure them that, in fact, there is a NATO commitment that would support them.
Well, let's take that short break. Wolfgang, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
The Delaware Art Museum supports WHYY and presents Fashion, Circus, Spectacle, photographs by Scott Heiser, on view through June 1st. This retrospective exhibition features Heiser's dramatically cropped photographs of fashion runways, circuses, dance competitions, and the Westminster Kennel Club dog shows, as well as sensitive portraits of famous faces from the 1970s and 80s. For more information, 302-571-9590 or online at delart.org.
On the next Fresh Air, author Penelope Lively discusses her new memoir, which she calls The View from Old Age. She's 81.
I have a certain impatience with contemporaries who are not making much of a fist of it, complaining too much. We're all in the same boat, frankly.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
In an era of constant distractions, one magic resource could be the secret to high performance and life fulfillment. Focus. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, psychologist and journalist Daniel Goleman delves into the latest research on attention, how we can stay focused, and use self-discipline to meet our goals. Today at noon, here on WHYY FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Residents of Crimea went to the polls yesterday and voted to join Russia in a referendum that was backed by Moscow, called illegal by Ukraine, the United States, and its European allies. The vote raises the military stakes in the region, where tensions have been increasing, and it poses a number of diplomatic challenges. We are talking about all of this with Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer. He was U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine from 1998 to 2000. He's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Also with us, William Burke White from the University of Pennsylvania Law School. In fact, Deputy Dean and Professor of Law. And he served in the Obama administration, part of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's policy planning staff. We had a Facebook question. I'm going to toss this to you, Stephen Pfeiffer. This goes back a number of decades. Why did Crimea go to Ukraine and not to Russia when it was the breakup of the Soviet Union?
Yeah, well, this goes back to history. In actually, Crimea was actually part of the Russian Soviet Socialist Republic until 1954, when the Russian government, Nikita Khrushchev, decided to transfer Crimea from Russia to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. That was to mark the 300th anniversary of the Treaty of Pereslav, which Russia saw as the treaty that united Russia and Ukraine back in 1654. And this was not a problem as long as there was a Soviet Union. But when the Soviet Union broke up in 1991, it then became an issue. There was initially, on the part of the outside world and on the part of the Russian government, though, a decision to recognize the states within the borders as of 1991. That was a politically wise decision because, as many people asked, if you start opening up one border, for example, to transfer Crimea back to Russia, what about hundreds of other border claims? And you, it could very quickly unravel into just decades of redrawing the border line. So the idea was recognize the post-Soviet republics in their current border. And that was something that, for the 1990s, under President Yeltsin, the Russians respected. There were periodic times, for example, when the Russian parliament would assert some kind of sovereignty over Crimea or over Sevastopol, the main port city in Crimea. But Yeltsin always came out and said, no, we respect Ukrainian territorial integrity. Crimea is a part of Ukraine. Unfortunately, Vladimir Putin does not seem to share that view.
Let me get Dave from Clinton, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Dave, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. My question is basically that, you know, I understand that this is completely illegal by Russia to use force and all of that, but I'm more concerned about the vote. You keep describing it as an illegal vote, and I would like to understand better why it's really considered illegal. I mean, doesn't it represent the will of the people if 90% of the electorate voted and they voted to secede? I mean, okay, fine, they need to do this by political processes and not by some military process. But is it legitimate? I mean, how different is it from, say, Puerto Rico voting to become independent from the United States?
No, it's a fair question, Dave. I'm glad you raised it. I'm going to toss that to you, Bill.
Sure. So there's a couple things we have to think about in asking whether the vote is legitimate. The first is the process that leads up to it legitimate? And under international law, as I said earlier, populations do have a right to exercise this kind of self-determination when they have been oppressed and when there's a very legitimate and deliberate process. That deliberate process requires a period of reflection and conversation, and that's what didn't happen here. Again, if you look at Kosovo, if you look at East Timor, or if you look at unsuccessful attempts like Puerto Rico or Quebec, they've all had a long period of deliberation and conversation so that the population can make that determination. The second thing I think that's really important to emphasize is, who is the polity? You said that 97% of the people voted, but we have to ask, what's the right population? Where do we draw the border lines? If we drew the border lines in the right way, you're calling from Clinton, New Jersey, Clinton, New Jersey might decide to succeed. secede from the United States. So here I think that's a real concern. It's also a concern that it appears that most of the people who voted were Russian passport holders. There's a lot of Russian passport holders in Ukraine. And we have to ask, was this a free and fair process in which the entire community was able to vote and had, as Stephen mentioned earlier, the right set of options on the table, right? Were all the options on the table? And part of that period of deliberation is figuring out what the options are to put to the voters. So maybe there should be a right to vote here. I don't think the requisite oppression was shown, but if it was, maybe there's a right to vote. But this should take 6 months, a year, 5 years, where that is truly deliberately and legally done.
What do you think, Stephen Pfeiffer?
Well, I would agree with those points, and I would add a couple of others. I mean, first of all, this kind of referendum was illegal under the Ukrainian constitution, and there was no dialogue at all between Crimea and Kyiv about this referendum, as Bill points out. But I also think that there are some very serious questions about the vote that was reported yesterday. No doubt there are a large number of people in Crimea who support the idea of either drawing closer to or even joining Russia. That's not in dispute. But the 97% figure sounds a little bit strange. They said 97% based on 80% turnout, which suggests about 75 to 78% of the population voted. Only 60% of the population is ethnic Russian. Mm-hmm. The Crimean Tatars, who are about 12% of the population, essentially boycotted the vote. So it would seem like in that vote, a whole bunch of ethnic Ukrainians voted to go to Russia, which seems at best implausible. Moreover, there are a lot of anecdotes coming out. One reporter, who is a Russian citizen with a Russian passport, she has no Crimean residency, walked in with her passport, was able to vote. There's reports of kids being allowed to vote, reports of people voting multiple times, and there were no credible international observers there. So, my guess is, a lot of people in that vote yesterday would have voted for either independence or for drawing closer to Russia. But the 97% figure sounds pretty Soviet-like.
Stephen Pfeiffer, do you think the Ukrainian government did anything to precipitate this crisis? And I'm thinking about the demotion of the Russian language, for instance, whether that was sort of a thumb in the eye.
That was, I think, it was a mistake made by the parliament the day after Mr. Yanukovych had fled the capital. It was rectified 5 days later when the acting president vetoed it. And I think since then they have been very careful, not only with an eye to Crimea, but also with an eye to eastern Ukraine, that they want to be inclusive and not do things that frighten away either ethnic Russians or Russian language speakers.
We have an email from Janet. It needs to be highlighted that Russia still occupies 20% plus of sovereign Georgia and continues a policy of creeping annexation. Bill?
Yeah, the 20% figure depends a little bit on how you draw the borders of some contested territories, but Russia seems to have, since really the Georgia crisis, engaged in a strategic set of actions where it provides passports to ethnic Russians in that country and claims a right to protect them, and then takes steps to do so, sometimes militarily, sometimes politically, and then uses that to expand its either political reach or its actual territorial influence. That's a very dangerous precedent to allow, and I think that's one of the other things we have to be very careful about. How you let a country manufacture citizenship, manufacture rights of intervention. We have been sometimes two-faced about when we say we have a right to intervention. That's why our own foreign policy has to be very careful on this front. But Russia is using this as a means to expand at least its old sphere of influence, if not actual territorial sovereignty.
Let me get to Vanessa from Princeton to join our conversation. Hi, Vanessa. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Good
Hi
morning.
Good morning.
First of all, I remind your panel that government in Ukraine is illegitimate. It's a result of the coup in which Americans participated. Number two, it is 400 miles from Moscow. Do you really think that the country which lost 20 million people in Second World War will allow anybody to get close, which is the goal of America and her so-called alliances?
Well, let me
Why do you not talk real history here and real facts? Why do you invite people who literally are propaganda people, and Americans will never get real sense. If we want to talk about Kosovo, the whole world know what's happening.
Well,
talk? No, let me finish.
Well, hold
if
on.
You
okay.
cut me, then the whole. Why don't you talk that America has 750 bases all over the world? and put the biggest base in Kosovo, and that was the goal.
Okay, fair
enough.
Please
talk the truth.
Okay, well, we are talking the truth, and I stand by the guests that we have booked on the show because I think they add a lot to the conversation. Obviously, it's a very complicated issue with many different points of view. Stephen Pfeiffer, let me take her original point, saying the government in Ukraine, in Kiev, is illegal because of the coup. Is she right in any way?
Well, I fundamentally disagree with her assessment. The idea that this is a Western-engineered coup, I think, shows great disrespect and is very condescending to the Ukrainian people, you know, who in sometimes numbers of 500,000 went out to protest about their desire to draw closer to Europe, about the corruption of the Yanukovych government, about the greater authoritarianism of the Yanukovych government. Now, I think there is a kernel of truth in the sense that when on February 21, an agreement was signed between Mr. Yanukovych and the three main opposition leaders that provided for creation of a national unity government. It provided for changing the Ukrainian constitution to move some authority away from the president to the Ukrainian parliament and the Ukrainian prime minister. And it called for moving up the presidential election from 2015 to the fall of 2014. Immediately after signing that document, Yanukovych fled. Mm. Now, I'm not sure if that agreement could have been sold to the protesters. They wanted to see Yanukovych gone immediately, but there was never a chance to test the proposition because Yanukovych disappeared. 6 days later, he turned up in Russia. Now, the next day, the Ukrainian parliament acted to vote to remove Mr. Yanukovych from the president, given that he fled. My sense is that they did not observe the exact form of the constitutional requirement of Ukraine in terms of impeachment, but it seemed to be a sort of a moot case because the president had left the country. He'd basically abdicated his duties. So you can quibble about whether what happened back on February 22nd was constitutional or not, but I think they have moved in a politically reasonable way, and what they have done is they've called a presidential election for May 25, which is the best way to let the Ukrainian people express their view, choose a president who will then have complete democratic legitimacy.
Vanessa, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you think, Bill, though, the United States has designs on this part of the world?
I don't, and let me actually answer another part of Vanessa's question pretty directly, which is to say I moved to the Soviet Union when I was 13 years old and became a Soviet Boy Scout. I lived actually in Crimea at a Soviet Boy Scout camp, and I spent 8 years of my life studying the Russian language and Russian history. And I have a great deal of sympathy for her concerns about, you know, the status of Russia having a Western-leaning state at its borders. I understand that history, and it's why I would not necessarily be in favor of Ukraine joining NATO, because I think that would put too much fear in the Russian people. And Russia has a good reason to say it wants to protect its borders. This is a totally different question. This is about one country unilaterally using force to occupy another. And if anything should scare Russia, it's that, because that's exactly what the fear ought to stem from. So I think we have to separate those historical elements out in a pretty important way. In terms of U.S. designs on the Ukraine, no. The U.S. has no desire to put bases in the Ukraine or to take over the Ukraine. I'm happy to criticize some U.S. foreign policy choices. Kosovo was not about a new place for U.S. bases. That just isn't necessary. It's not something the U.S. is trying to do. So I hope we can dispel those rumors.
Let me get Adrian from Fairmount to join our conversation. Adrian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, your guest expressed, I guess you could call it admiration for the restraint shown by Ukraine so far, the armed forces dealing with the situation in Crimea. But as we all know, Russia is fomenting unrest, separatist unrest in the eastern and southern parts of the country, which will only increase in scope and aggressiveness. I am just wondering, how long does the West, you know, what are their expectations as far as Ukraine continuing to be exercise restraint? After all, at some point, Ukraine has to stop itself from being carved up by Russia.
Well, I appreciate the call, Adrian, and that's a question for you, Stephen Pfeiffer.
No, I think the Ukrainian military has exercised great restraint in Crimea. though my guess is that if there is a Russian military intervention into, say, eastern Ukraine or coming out of Crimea, the Crimean Peninsula into southern Ukraine, I think that the Ukrainian military will then fight. There were reports and pictures over the weekend of Ukraine deploying, you know, some of its armored personnel carriers both towards the Russian border and then down towards the top of peninsula of Crimea. Now, my guess is that it would be very hard for the Ukrainian military to prevail in this, but I think that they will be prepared to fight if there is now military action or military intervention into Ukraine proper. But there's a second point here, and I think it's very important to understand, is that eastern Ukraine is very different from Crimea. Crimea is the only part of Ukraine where ethnic Russians are in a majority. In eastern Ukraine, it's majority ethnic Ukrainians. And when I was there in the 1990s, I would say that in eastern Ukraine, that sense of national identity, it was not as deep as it was in western Ukraine, but it was there. And you haven't, as far as I can tell, seen a big push from the population for separatism in eastern Ukraine or to join Russia, aside from these relatively limited demonstrations in places like big cities in eastern Ukraine, such as Donetsk and Kharkiv. And there's a lot of anecdotal reporting that suggests that these are really being organized by Russians who come across the border and then head and start up a pro-Russia demonstration.
Wow. About a minute before we have to say goodbye, is there any way that you could think about this, Bill? And I read a couple of op-eds that if Russia gets Crimea, they get the booby prize.
Yeah, I think, Russia will then be in a very difficult political situation, trying to navigate the complexities of dealing with a very unhappy Europe, a very unhappy United States, and perhaps the rest of the world that's deeply skeptical. It also makes the rest of the world on Russia's borders very scared, and I think that's a danger that Russia doesn't want to walk into.
You get the last word, Stephen Pfeiffer, about 20 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, one last unintended consequence of this is that if the Ukrainian population was perhaps 52% in favor of drawing closer to the European Union 3 months ago, I think that they have solidified the view in Ukraine for moving towards the European Union. They're very nervous now about Russia.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Stephen Pfeiffer, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And from 1998 to 2000, he was the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. William Burke-White, thank you very much as well.
The pleasure was mine.
And he's deputy dean professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. And from 2009 to 2011, he served in the Clinton secretary of the Clinton State Department. There you go. Advising Hillary Clinton on Russia, among other issues. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for those phone calls as well. And do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.